Welcome to the E-Commerce Momentum Podcast, where we focus on the people, the products, and the process of e-commerce selling today. Here's your host, Stephen Peterson.
Welcome back to the E-Commerce Momentum Podcast. This is episode 87, Rachel Greer. Man, oh man, I now know why somebody recommended I have Rachel Greer on. As a matter of fact, he was pretty emphatic. He's like, Steve, you've got to have her on. You will blown away. And let me tell you, I was blown away. Rachel is clearly very intelligent, very well educated, very matter of fact, very curt. Kind of comes up, you'll understand that, been trained that way. But my goodness, what a level of knowledge. In this segment, we spend a lot of time talking about Amazon. Rachel was an employee of Amazon, a senior employee in Amazon. So she's moved up, worked a lot of different jobs, and she gives her perspective. And I think it's such great perspective. It really helps you understand a little bit more of the environment, the competitive environment, and not in a negative way. It is what it is. It's a results-oriented company. We all know that because we sell on it. Now you'll understand a little bit more of why things are the way they are. Let's get into the podcast. All right, welcome back to the E-Commerce Momentum Podcast. And tonight's guest was recommended by somebody that, like, Steve, you have to have this person on. She is so smart, so much perspective, has a background in Amazon, knows a little bit about them. Rachel Greer. Welcome, Rachel.
Thanks for having me.
You know, it is a mystery, that Amazon company, you know, your side of it, when you work on the employee side of it. My little town, they have four warehouses in my town now, which is crazy to me. So you go out to a party, you're bound to run into somebody who works in a warehouse. But in Seattle, are you bound to run into somebody who works in one of their corporate offices?
Yes.
Pretty much. Well, I love the way you told me how long you've been there. You're like, I was there when there were still, we all fit in three buildings. How many buildings do they take now?
Oh, I don't even know. By the time I left, it was over 20.
Wait. 20 buildings?
Yeah, so there's this kind of joke that Amazon's taken over South Lake Union, which is the part of Seattle that's just north of downtown. And it used to be owned, I think it's Paul Allen who owned a big portion of that. And he started developing it because it used to be where, like, the Hostess factory was, and there was a bunch of industrial stuff there. So they developed it, and they've basically built this entire giant office park in about a 7 by 10 square block area of Seattle. And so over the past 15 years, it's become unrecognizable. Like, you wouldn't even notice that that's the part of Seattle you're in if you came back after 15 years. And when we first moved there, there were, I think, 5 or 6 leased buildings. And then Amazon decided to buy 3 blocks in downtown Seattle and bought them in cash, which was pretty fun.
Wow.
It was the highest cost per square foot real estate transaction in the U.S. at that time ever. So a very expensive real estate transaction. And I believe they've already started on the parking garage for the third building. So the first building is already in play. It's a high rise. And then the second two buildings are in progress right now, along with the dome. So it's a pretty cool looking little futuristic dome that they've added in the dog park and everything. It's a pretty neat looking facility. I actually really like the building because it's got really colorful glass panels on the side. And most office buildings are really boring, and this one's kind of fun.
A little inspiring maybe, right? Because you want to be inspired when you go to work.
Yeah, yeah. I think the coolest thing about working for Amazon was that it was a dog-friendly workplace.
So people would bring in, I mean, people weren't bringing in pit bulls and stuff, were they?
Oh, absolutely. In fact, my favorite dog who came in was actually a pit bull named Oscar. And Oscar is a big white pitty, and he is just the sweetest dog. And as soon as he saw me, he'd all start wiggling his butt because he knew that I'd go get him some bacon.
Now, were there not like this TV show dog fights, but I mean, you know, animals can get aggressive to each other. What happens when that happens?
Actually, the most aggressive animal who was there for a while was this little French bulldog, and it would just get really annoyed about anyone getting in its space, and then would get mad and would, like, do dog farts. And I don't know if you've ever been around a French bulldog, but they have amazingly stinky dog farts. It's not cool. Oh. So that's another aspect of being in a dog-friendly workplace is that, you know, they smell and they have accidents or they get sick. And actually, my dog ended up being kind of the most aggro in a way. If anyone kind of interrupted her naps or her food or invaded our space, she would growl at them and make them go away. So,
so tell me what that did to the workforce. So what did it, I mean, so the fact, I mean, because that's the thing that you seem to love the most. So obviously that struck an impression upon you. I mean, what do you think that brought to the workplace?
So there, Amazon is a very high stress workplace. I don't think this can be overstated in any way. I think that anyone who has ever worked at a workplace where everything that you do is tracked and every step you do is measured and you are called to task for it in public forums every week, the amount of stress that can induce is pretty significant. And Amazon also has a policy of putting 10% of employees in the bottom, basically the bottom chunk of employees every year. Everyone's put into different groups. It's basically a matrix kind of approach. And there's always 10% who are kind of at the bottom in various ways. And so you know that if you miss your numbers or you miss something that's significant or you have a pretty significant issue that occurs, that you're likely going to be put on a performance improvement plan and moved out. And so it's a constant struggle to keep on top of everything and never to have any mistakes. Or at least if they are mistakes, correct them very quickly.
Well, because they're all high achievers, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, and so you're competing with other high – it's not like, you know, you can just come in as a cakewalk. Now, you have some pretty advanced degrees. What does a program manager do for Amazon?
That's the kind of catch-all term for people who do the stuff that I did, which was basically you're given a particular project or program, and then you're responsible for all the aspects of making it launch. And to get to that point, you have to define what your goals are. You have to define what your steps are to get there. You have to define what the pieces are that you need to achieve that goal, and then you've got to follow up with them and get it done. And I think that's actually one of the things that's made me fairly successful in launching and growing the business is that we never really had that much support doing any of this at Amazon. It was always very self-driven. And so it's very similar to what I'm doing now, which is that I have to do it myself. There's no one else who's going to help me. And so
did they give you the resources, though? Did they give you the resources?
Oh, no, you have to go get the resources.
Oh,
so you really do have to, like, one time I really, really needed something done. And so I baked some cookies and took a 2-liter Mountain Dew to the programmer who I knew could help me. And I begged him for a couple hours of his time. So you really do have to solve the problems yourself. And that kind of comes back to why the dogs are so important is because there are some days that you literally just want to punch a wall, but I don't recommend it because a lot of the buildings are made from concrete. So instead of doing that, then you go take a walk with the dog or you go pet the dog or you play with the dog and you can focus more on what you're trying to do, what you're trying to accomplish once you get the kind of frustration and anger out by hanging out with a happy little furry friend.
How many projects would you be working on at a time?
Oh, gosh. It depended on the role that I was on. But when I was managing private brands compliance, we were running probably 2 to 3 different projects launching each week. So keeping on top of those, I had employees that I managed. And then we also had technical projects. So what's the technology that's needed to improve and scale the business? And so I would manage those. I would say probably at any given time, there were 6 to 10 large projects going on and many dozens of small projects launching at the same time.
Well, I know people are going to be like, Steve, you should ask her a little bit more. What's private? Did you say private label compliance? Is that what you
called it? Yeah, so it was called private brands for a while. I don't know what they're calling it right now, but private brands being the idea that they're Amazon brands, but not necessarily private label, because there are a lot of products that Amazon does, like on Amazon Basics, that are more private label type products where they're copies of something else, essentially, with maybe a feature improvement or a color improvement. But there were some brands that were actually designed brands. They were just in-house brands.
So somebody came up with something and you found a source to have it made and you brought it to market.
Correct.
To the Amazon market.
Right. And it's an official Amazon brand. So there are a broad variety of these kinds of brands. And Amazon's very good, as I mentioned, it's very entrepreneurial. So it's very good at giving people the freedom to try new things. And as long as you can meet your core goals while also trying the new things, then great, have fun, have at it. So there were some people who were pretty successful at bringing new brands to market. And some that weren't successful. And
those I'm sure some weren't, right? I'm sure it goes both ways. Well, but that's when they make the bottom 10%. So tell me this. Is it as difficult for Amazon to bring a product to market as it is for a third-party seller to bring to market?
I would say yes and no. The area that Amazon will have an advantage is the name recognition when dealing with the factory. So there's a little bit greater ease there in terms of getting someone to talk to you. But in terms of the actual difficulty of developing a product, no, it's difficult however you slice it. You need to find a factory that can actually make the product. You need to supervise the making of said product, make sure that it's safe and compliant, meets safety requirements, regulatory requirements, make sure that it can get through customs, which is still a very paper-heavy process, very manual, and then make sure that that product has photography done, that it has good content, and then gets up on the website. So one of the areas that Amazon's been very successful in terms of scaling their business as a whole is by outsourcing pretty much all of the work that needs to be done to the vendors and the sellers. So the vendors need to help with marketing. The sellers have to develop their own pages. Photography is supplied. Amazon does a lot of photography, but for all the seller items on the website, that's supplied by the sellers. So Amazon does a really good job pushing off a lot of that work and the sourcing process onto the sellers and the vendors on the platform. The problem when you're doing your own brand is you have to do it yourself. So there's no really good way to scale that because you're actually doing things and you're manipulating things. So no, it's not really any easier. You just have more money. So that helps.
Well, you described it that you'd have challenge. You'd have to go find these resources. So in that scenario, are you given the resources to bring it to market, or are you back out there baking cookies and bringing the dog and petting it and that kind of thing?
It depended on the situation. So when it came to launching a new product, usually we would have a budget that we needed to meet. And if the product didn't fit within those budget tenets, then it wouldn't get done. So if something, for whatever reason, the cost for testing was way too high, then we'd have to figure out a way around that. Or if the cost of samples was too high, then we'd have to figure out a way around that. So Amazon also flies coach. I mean, there's just a lot of things where it's about being frugal and about being careful with money. And so if it's something that wouldn't make sense for you as a private label seller, it may make sense for Amazon not to do it either. There's a lot of areas where Amazon's been very frugal with how things are launched and how things are done.
So if you brought a product to market and it was successful, how are you rewarded, if you can say?
You get to be part of the either middle or top tier of employees.
Oh, okay.
It's really
is there a different benefit to be in than that? Are they bonus plans different or?
Nope. No.
You just stay out of the bottom.
There. It's you have your job and you have stock. And the idea with stock is that everyone is an owner. And so if the stock does well, Amazon's performing well. Amazon, like there's a uptick in the stock when there was an announcement of Amazon's new brands that have come out recently. And that's where you get your bonus, right? If you are part of a successful launch and you help make Amazon successful, then your stock price goes up.
Okay, so you really do get some stake in the game, if you like it. And so is that the way you would say most people feel outside of the pressure side of it when, you know, that, hey, you know, I own a little piece of that?
If you've been there long enough, yes. The way that the compensation structures work are different if you've been there a long time versus if you're new. So people who have been there longer have more stock, and they do have more of that ownership mentality.
That's interesting to hear, though, that they have the same struggles we do bringing products to market. Do they have the same products or same issues with distribution? You know, you're on the other side of it, so you can say this, right? Do they have the same problems with distribution that we have sometimes? I mean, they're a company that ships, right? And so they have their own internal struggles?
Well, the same issues exist, right? You want to get the product to the customer as quickly as possible and in the condition it expects, that the customer expected it to be in. So the struggle there is really how I've set up the consulting business that I have, is basically doing private label the Amazon way. And by that, I mean that one of the main struggles of anyone who's doing e-commerce is packaging. And it's something that for a lot of Chinese suppliers, they don't understand how e-commerce works and the kind of abuse that a package can go through being in either Amazon's FCs or just going through the UPS and truck and air system. So if you can imagine, most of these factories are used to putting in thin paperboard packaging, then putting it onto a pallet, making sure the pallet is safe. Then once it gets to a big box store, it gets unloaded onto a shelf and then purchased and taken home from there. So that paperboard package never has to be bounced around in a tote, never has to be squashed in a box in a UPS truck, never has to go on a plane and get things dumped on it. It's a very different experience for a box to go into a retail store than to be shipped by Amazon or by your own e-commerce store. So one of the things that we focus on is making sure that all the packaging is ISTA 3A compliant, which is what's required.
Say that again.
Frustration-free packaging.
Say that again, that first part. What compliant?
ISTA 3A, ISTA 3A. Okay. ISTA is an international standard making organization for packaging. So they basically say how often the item should be drop tested, at which angles, how long it should be on the vibrating platform to mimic being on a truck. And then at the end of it, the product still needs to be in pristine condition. The package needs to have protected the product. And most retail packaging can't protect the product. So that's one of the biggest challenges, I would say, that a lot of sellers aren't thinking about when they're thinking about launching their own brand on Amazon. They're not thinking about the difficulty of making sure that their package is stiff enough to stand up to the abuse. And then what happens is the product arrives at the end customer's home. They open the box and it's all smashed up on one side. So they get upset and they, you know, say that you're selling used products or saying that you're selling something that's not as described because it wasn't supposed to look like this. And then you get the dreaded emails from Amazon saying we've received a buyer complaint about the condition of your item. So that's, I think, the number one kind of challenge that we see with a lot of the folks that we work with is just understanding the importance of packaging and how packaging affects your entire Amazon account.
Wow. No, you just blew my mind. Now I know why they wanted you on. Okay, so we're going to take a quick break. We're going to come back. I want to hear why you left Amazon and where Think Cascadia came from. Okay, we'll be right back. All right, it's early in 2016. You just came off a slamming fourth quarter 2015. You're sitting on a boatload of cash and you're thinking, I want to do something for my business. I want to grow. Start looking at end foundation. Look at them as building blocks. Build, build, build. Change your categories. Think about gated categories, specifically shoes and clothing. YourSourcedInventory.com, that's what they focus on. You'll get a list every single day of the week, Monday through Friday, and they're going to give you leads for about 10 items that are in the shoes and clothing, and even dipping into the sports and outdoor category, which is great. These are all gated categories. Listen to some of these ranks. In October, the average shoe rank was $7,571 for $29 profit, a return of investment of 88%. December, 11,000 ranking, profit of $32, 83% ROI. Think about that. Profit of $32. What's your average selling price? Imagine what your average selling price would jump to. In clothing, ranking in October, $6,800, profit of $1,488. But listen to this, ROI of 109%. What could you do to get that 109% return? You got to join YourSourcedInventory.com. We use it as foundational in our business. We think you should too. YourSourcedInventory.com. Very, very, very cool, man. I'm telling you, I love learning. And Rachel is, you know, just really a great wealth of knowledge. In this segment, we really break down her consulting business and her and a bunch of partners, and she names them all, and not downplaying that at all. They all have a role, but they're all, almost everyone in the company had worked at Amazon in some role, in a senior role in some cases, and they have a specialty, but they have a specialization. And I think that that's so cool because they know the inner workings. They can guide you through. And I was thinking about, you know, if you had a product, you know, is this the kind of company that you would bring in on your product? And it's expensive. I'm sure it's, you know, quite a bit of money. But imagine the possibilities of what they could do for you to legitimize your product and to really help you create a real sustainable long-term business. I am blown away. The professionalism, the knowledge, just amazing. And I just think it's such a great interview. Let's get back into it. All right, we're back and we're talking with Rachel Greer, and she has a company called ThinkCascadia.com, right? Cascadia Seller Solutions, that website, I should say, ThinkCascadia.com, and I'll have a link for it. And you were working for Amazon, plugging along in a stressful environment, albeit with a dog, and things are going well, and you decide to leave. Can I ask you why you decided to leave?
Yeah, it was a couple things that all kind of came to a head at the same time. So one of the more challenging aspects of being a manager at Amazon is that you have to decide which of your employees falls into those buckets.
Oh.
So, right, you see the challenge, right?
Yeah, that's tough. I mean, this is an old GE, style of management. That was it.
Yeah,
the bottom 10% get cut every year.
Problem with it, right? So the whole idea with Jack Welch is the reason why he came up with this was that he got a review his first year as a newbie at GE and got ticked off that his raise was the same as everyone else's. And he talked to his manager and said, hey, I've been performing like crazy. I'm awesome. You need to give me a better raise. And the manager said, that's not how it works. And his whole concept was, if you have a top performer, you need to do whatever you can to retain that top performer, including giving them double the pay each year. If they're actually that good, then you keep them whatever the cost. And then the idea being that your bottom performers are such a dead weight on the organization and brings down everyone else to such an extent that you have to get rid of them or they'll poison the whole bunch. So that's the concept. Hmm. Where it kind of falls on its face is that there is no there's no concept of helping your top performers at Amazon. So you do get promoted and you do get more money as you get promoted. But the problem is you're under just as much pressure every year, and it's still just as frustrating. And I was hiring people because I'd been there for so long. I was hiring people who made more money than I did, and that got kind of frustrating.
Sure.
And then the other thing that happened was one of the challenges about working at Amazon is that it is very entrepreneurial, and so there's a lot that's put on everyone's plate, and you figure out how to do it, and you focus on the things that will be the most successful or that will be of most value for you for the year, and then you do it. And most of the time, there isn't a lot of time for chit-chat. There isn't a lot of time for kind of niceties, I guess, is the best way to put it. You just get it done. You get in, you get out. There's not a lot of space to be kind, I guess.
Yeah, polite, right? You're just bowling over people to get it done.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's actually part of the Amazon, what they call leadership principles. There's one of them that actually says that leaders do not go along to get along, and they do not agree to preserve social cohesion.
Ouch. So that could get old. I could see that.
But do you think
you were an entrepreneur?
That I had a problem with it. I actually was fine with it. What I had a problem with was when new people would come in and they weren't expecting that, and they'd get really mad at you. And I was like, I'm not trying to be mean. I'm just trying to do my job, and I don't have time to spend on being nice. If I spend time on being nice, that's an extra 5 hours a week that I don't have spending on my projects.
So they're thinking you're being curt when you're really just being efficient, right? We got to get going. Let's go.
Exactly. Okay. And new people who would come in would get really frustrated and angry, and that would take more time to try to soothe them. And then I was behind even more. And I was like, I can't keep up in this environment. I'm feeling too stressed. I'm too miserable. The whole team is changing. I don't want to be part of this anymore.
And would you say that you're an entrepreneur?
Or just leave the company entirely? And I was like, you know what? I think it's time for something new.
Well, I cut you off, and I apologize for that, because what I'm hearing, and I wonder if it came out, and that's why you're saying, wait a second, because you described that you learn how to figure things out, and you become very self-sufficient, and you can move things forward, and if you're really good at it, you move up, and obviously you were. Were you an entrepreneur trapped in a company?
I think that's exactly what it was. That Amazon, as it used to be, was very entrepreneurial. And the people who got hired were given goals, and you figure it out or you fail, which is like running your own business. You figure it out or you fail, and you better figure it out quick. Ramp up time is like maybe a month if you're lucky. And that was actually really appealing to me. I really like taking on challenges, and I really like not being bored.
And you're not bored based on what you're doing. You got a lot going on.
Yeah,
it's just interesting to me that
much more of a company now. It's much more structured, and there's a lot more layers. And people actually say things like, I went to 5 meetings this week about this, and that's like an accomplishment. And I'm like, a meeting is not an accomplishment. I'm sorry.
So some of that, probably the better part of it, hopefully you're a little more polite though, right? You're not quite as, you're a little nicer, right? You're not doing that. But you expect results.
Exactly. Yeah. I don't want to be mean to people or call them names or anything, but the goal is to solve the problem. At the end of the day, we're all trying to launch a good product to solve the problems that we're working on Amazon. And, you know, if we want to do it quickly and we want to do it efficiently, then that takes less time than trying to be nice about it. And one thing that I do think was really valuable about the way that Amazon approached problems is you would basically all attack the idea in a room. So you'd have like this piece of paper that you write a report and a proposal, and you put it out in front of everyone. And everyone reads it, and then they started just tearing it apart, essentially. Well, what about this? Have you thought about this? Have you considered this issue? Have you considered that issue? Well, what about this? I don't think those numbers add up. And then by the time that you're done with having this report or this proposal that you've written torn apart, it's a way better proposal. And I think that's the area that a lot of times people forget when they're like, oh, but that's really not nice, is, yeah, my job isn't to be nice. My job is to be accurate and correct and to give you the best possible information. And if I'm not doing that, then I'm not serving you well as your consultant. My whole thing is to say, I have all this experience. If I spend time trying to make you feel good about it, then you may end up having problems with your account that otherwise you wouldn't have if I'd been a lot more direct and said, you know what, this particular thing that you're doing is going to get you in trouble. Regardless of how nice I think you are and how much I like you as a person, this thing you're doing is going to cause problems. And so that's really where we try to come from, is really try to separate the person from the activity.
Well, let's talk about what you do, because I'm looking at your core competencies. And I think I would jump to the product testing, safety, regulatory, and quality. So we've already talked about the box, the packaging, right? And so that's a service that you offer advice for a fee. To help somebody take a product and get it to market, or one that people are starting to experience a problem with, or both?
Both.
Okay.
So if someone has a bunch of customer complaints about something, then we investigate it, we look at it, we do test buys, and then recommend improvements in packaging. And it could just be something as simple as buying an overbox, or it could be something more complicated like getting wood pulp molds. So wood pulp is fully recyclable. It's a great product for keeping things safe in an e-commerce environment. And you can just add, sometimes as simple as just adding corners to a box to keep it nice and square to protect the product inside. So depending on the issue, then we'll recommend specific solutions.
And so you've had customers who've had all those issues, obviously. And were they able to get to the point where that quality issue is gone? I mean, that's ultimately the goal, right? To get it past that point where they stop. How do you measure that?
So most of the time when customers come to us, so when we engage with clients, it's because Amazon's actually shut down their listing.
Oh, well, that's a given, right? Now you got a place to start, right? You know, hey, whoa, this isn't right. So you're coming up with a plan, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, based on that whole thing. And so you're writing, it's part of your service where you're helping write the letters and here's my action plan. Here's what I'm going to do, A, B, C, D.
Exactly.
And then, okay.
Yeah.
Okay. And so you can help get reinstatement. And do you help with account shutdown reinstatements too?
Yes. So my area of specialty is really on product quality and compliance, since that's what I did at Amazon. My partner, Kelly Johnston, who can also see on the website, she actually used to be the former manager of seller performance at Amazon. So she actually is deeply, deeply knowledgeable about seller performance and handles issues like that for account reinstatements. And really the area where she just completely excels is pretty much every part of those metrics that you go into where you have performance in that whole performance tab. So how to manage late shipment rate, how to manage the cancellation rate, how does a liquidation model affect you on Amazon? How does a dropship model affect you? How does an arbitrage model affect you? How does a private label model affect you? My experience is almost entirely in branded goods, so I really only focus there. Kelly does a lot more broadly support with clients in a variety of selling situations.
Oh, wow. I mean, now I'm really blown away. So are there other ex-Amazon employees working in the company?
Yes, all of us.
Oh, wow. Tell me more, because there's a whole bunch of you. So, mm-hmm. So you know, it's interesting. So I get where your specialty is. I get where her specialty is. Who's next, and what would be their specialty? You don't have to name them by name, but I'm just interested.
So another partner in the firm is Emily Murray, and she was actually in customer service in the late 90s, and then again doing customer service escalations for the product safety team. And those are the customers who are usually pretty darn upset because somebody's already gotten hurt or something is lit on fire, and so they're pretty mad about it. And what she does is build blurb libraries and give coaching on how to manage customer service for sellers. So for myself, I am not a good customer service person. There have been plenty of times where I've been having a bad day, and it's just like, I don't want to deal with you. I don't want to deal with any of your problems. Go away.
Plus, you've been taught to be curt, right? We know that. You've already told us that.
And that's the other thing is I fit in with the culture well because that's how I am naturally. I prefer to keep things simple and to the point and not worry about all the fluff. And that's just my personality. And that's how I work. And Emily is a part-time yoga teacher, and she's just got this really warm personality and just it is a lot better at making people feel valued.
I can picture her with their hands there saying, all right, Steve, don't worry. Well, you know, you mentioned blurbs. So that's where somebody, they're pre-answered answers, right? Mm-hmm. So people ask a question and there's already an answer for it, right? Because these are the common questions and boom, you're pre-answering it. And that, like you're saying, that really does take away a whole bunch of, you know, oh, somebody else asked this question. Oh, good. They got a good answer and they seem satisfied with it, right?
Right, exactly. And if you tailor it to the tone of your company, it also makes a big difference in how customers perceive you and whether or not you can get those repeat customers. So maybe not repeat customers for products that are really a one-off novelty kind of item, but a lot of the stuff that does really well for private label customers, I mean, for private label clients that we have, are things people are going to buy again, and they'll remember if they had a good experience with you or not, and if they want to buy that product again. So having a blurb that basically has your tone, there's some companies that are really focused on being fun and engaging, and they use lots of emojis and exclamation points and have, you know, like comments about their hair or their day, you know, like there's things that you can make it really fun and personal and yet still be a blurb and consistent.
Well, as I'm sitting here reading these things and I'm thinking about only selling on Amazon, but these things are relevant to people's private websites, right? Their own e-commerce sites also. I mean, these things should be across all spectrums wherever they sell, right?
Yep, absolutely. I think that there's a few basic tenets to running a really good e-commerce store.
Oh, give them.
The first one is know your customer. Know what your customer wants and advertise for that and then produce that. The second piece is kind of the harder piece. A lot of people who do e-commerce sites are really good at advertising and marketing. That's why they're doing online stuff. They're really good at that. A lot of them are not as good at making sure that the product they sell actually meets what they're advertising. So that's mm-hmm. always an issue. So the first one is know your customer and then make sure you're getting them what they want. And then if there is an issue, then solve your customer's problem first. And so if the customer's problem is this thing is getting too slow, or I thought that this would be better, or I'm upset because of XYZ, all of those are things that can help you and improve your business. So listen to your customer, know what your customer wants, and solve those problems. And then something that's particular to Amazon is really keep on top of your metrics. Don't ever let your metrics falter. If you rise above 1% ODR, the order defect rate, you will get suspended. It's very simple. So don't let it happen. And if you're selling a product that, for whatever reason, the customers keep complaining about it, it will likely get shut down too. And if that happens enough, then your account can get shut down. So Amazon has been successful by being customer-centric. It's not employee-centric. It's not partner-centric. It's not competitor-centric. It's all about customers. And at the end of the day, if you don't take care of your customer, then no one's going to buy from you and you don't make any money. Mm. So taking Amazon's successful model of what does the customer want and how do I get it to them and how do I get it to them the way that they want it, and then remodeling that on your own site.
So back to your example with the poor packaging. So I'm thinking of an example of a product, Funko, right? So you think these little Funko figures, right? They're little, I don't know, little figures. The packaging is just poor, right? It just really is. So if you're sending them in just with a little label on them, stickered or non-stickered, whichever, the likelihood of them getting damaged somewhere between, you know, the UPS guy picking up to the fact that it gets to whatever warehouse and then it gets transferred to another warehouse is pretty great. So you're saying put in that scenario, we're putting an outer package on it to keep that expectation because the warehouse is going to be the warehouse and they're not responsible for the damage to the product. You sent it in and it was damaged, right?
Correct. They sometimes look upon receive, but not necessarily.
Right. So that example, you as a seller have a responsibility to say the likelihood of this thing making it in and making it out to the customer, as you described, you know, sitting on the Target shelf, it's easy, right? It's there. It looks great. Then it's easy to tell. The likelihood of that making it through is probably not so good. So I need to do something different rather than try to blame somebody else. I'm personally responsible all the way through the process.
Correct.
Correct?
Even if you're using FBA, and that's a huge challenge for a lot of sellers, especially doing online or retail arbitrage, they're not thinking about how they need to make sure that product arrives in pristine condition. With those kind of sellers doing wholesale or arbitrage, I usually recommend overboxing in some way, so just making the outer box sturdier. When we're doing our own branded products, we actually design a package specifically for that product. And I know I mentioned it before, but wood pulp is probably my favorite method to do this because making molds for wood pulp have become cheaper and cheaper. 3D printers are making things easier to make molds, and then you can make an easy silicone mold for relatively cheap. It used to be very expensive to do this kind of packaging because you had to actually make cast molds, and now that's not a requirement anymore.
Well, and this is a service you offer, right? So if I'm, you know, and I'm sitting here thinking about, you know, obviously you have a very sophisticated service organization, right? All experts at one part of the business and the other, right? So what size business is your normal customer? I mean, are they the guy that's going and buying Target end cap stuff and sending it in, or are they more established distributors of their own product or someone else's product? What do you see?
Right now, it's kind of across the board. So we're seeing folks who come into us for specifically for Kelly's expertise. We're seeing them come in from all...
Which is the violation end, right?
Exactly. So really okay. Seller performance. And on the seller performance side, we see all sizes. So it could even be people who are making millions a year who are violating the terms of service enough that they get suspended. And that's very unfortunate when that happens. Or they could be people who we had a couple clients who had sold like $200 worth of stuff before they got shut down. So oh, wow. It's really a broad variety on the enforcement and performance side. On the private label development side, we really only work on branded products. So if you're doing something where it's more traditional private label where you're just buying wholesale from a Chinese manufacturer and then putting your brand on it, that's really something, the only thing that I will help with on that specifically as a typical thing, because these are sellers usually who just want to turn something around and make some money. Mm-hmm. The only thing I usually support with there is compliance. So telling them this is a good thing to buy or not. You're going to get in trouble with this one. You're not going to get so much trouble with that one. That's pretty much it. But for what we do for branded goods, usually those are our larger sellers because the investment is pretty significant.
So give me an example of someone. Give me an example. I'm looking at a coffee mug, Starbucks coffee mug. We'll pick on poor Starbucks. So that would be a brand that's the kind of that level of customer, or Steve's coffee mugs. I mean, give me an example.
Oh,
I'm just trying
really
to understand.
Really, like Steve's coffee mugs. So,
okay.
The kind of work that we do, people who have large brands have these employees in house.
Okay.
Where we really excel is with companies who are trying to get into the product development space, but who were always either buying wholesale from someone else or were successful marketers and don't really know anything about product development and laws and regulations, or people who are successful wholesalers and now want to get into the importing business, which is much more complex, or people who have gotten successful arbitrage businesses and they're going to use that income to leverage moving into their own brands. So what we usually are focused on is what is the brand identity that you want to go for? Are you looking to do cheaper products and higher volume? Are you looking to do high-end products? Who is your target market? Is your target market a 40 to 60-year-old woman? Well, there's certain kinds of things that you want to do in terms of your photography, in terms of your brand colors. There's a whole bunch of different details that need to go into your branding piece of this, depending on who your target market is and what you're trying to achieve. So we're really trying to help people think critically about what they're trying to sell and have a coherent brand strategy. When we're talking about something like a coffee mug, for example, we have a lot of people who use things like silicone baking mats and garlic presses as jokes, like the
the salad forks and the marshmallow sticks or something, right?
That's a hot one. And a lot of people are just not even thinking about the fact that those products are touching food that you then eat. You are putting it in your body. So anyone who hasn't been paying attention to anything may not know this, but I think most of us have been. And the situation with Flint, with the water crisis, is really where that just kind of brings it home, what the risk is when you're not careful about what goes into the product. So in Flint, as hopefully we all know, the pipes that were made for the water supply system were made prior to 1986, before lead was outlawed in the U.S., and so most of the pipes in Flint, Michigan are lead pipes. They switched their water supply from Detroit, which had treated water, to the Flint River, which did not have treated water, and it was corrosive because of years of pollution. And the corrosion is a high acid content water, basically leached lead out of these pipes, and that's the reason why it came out kind of brownish to the end user in their home, because it was leaching all of the gunk from these pipes that were 50-100 years old. And then the people who drank that water then basically were poisoned. They have lead poisoning. The numbers for the children in Flint are so terrible that these children are losing between 5 and 10 IQ points from the amount of poisoning that they have. It's absolutely devastating. So that's really where we're trying to come from in terms of the compliance piece, is that when you put something into food, food automatically, depending on the kind of acid base, is it acidic, is it basic, what will it react with, is it a solvent like alcohol, how does it actually react with that product? Is the ceramic cup that you have, is the glaze on that lead-free? It might not be.
It might not be.
Yeah, and there's in fact a particular kind of Fiesta ware that was made in the 70s and 80s that actually had uranium in the glaze. So that was pretty fun.
So what point does somebody say that, you know, I need to take, you know, there must be an ideal way. And I guess this is what my mind went to when you were describing all this, right? So they have a product, they're selling whatever, they're selling somebody else's product. They want to do it on their own. They want to, you know, enhance it, make it better, blah, blah, blah. Is that the kind of customer that really comes to somebody like you? Because as you said, they don't have the in-house counsel. They don't have the staff to be able to develop this. Is that where a consulting company like yours is really going to stand out and be able to advance probably pretty quickly because you've got all this experience. You have a breadth of experience, right?
Right.
You think that's where the opportunity is?
Yeah, and a lot of times the school of hard knocks can be kind of expensive.
Yeah, it's a very expensive education.
Right, relying on our experience, because we've made our own mistakes and we've seen mistakes made, and we see things like people using one-time customs entry. And sometimes those kind of companies, the way that they do it, they're very high risk, and nearly everything that goes through them gets flagged. And so then your shipment could get flagged and held at the port while it's being examined. And in multiple cases, we've had client products turned away at the port and sent back. And that's actually the better option. The worst option is if they are found to be non-compliant, as in the product literally cannot be brought in because it is a hazard to human health, and the entire shipment has to be destroyed. So in one case, there was a product that we were discussing, and the product was junior size. Anything made for children in the United States, children are defined as 13 and under. Anything that's made for children has to meet the requirements of the Consumer Product Safety Improvement Act. And this particular junior size product, on the handle grip of the product, the adhesive holding the handle grip onto the handle was found to contain higher than the acceptable amount of lead, and the entire shipment had to be destroyed, and the seller was out that entire cost because they took it from the Chinese supplier and never told the Chinese supplier what they were doing with it, and the Chinese supplier refused to refund them for it. So they actually were able to get a discount on the next shipment that was more compliant. The supplier at least worked with them on that, but it was a huge loss.
What is product benchmarking?
So when we first start out with a new product, we get a lot of people who come in who have ideas that are maybe not awesome.
So my coffee mug idea, you mean Steve's coffee mug idea, might not be the best one, you're saying, right?
A standard coffee mug, probably not.
Okay,
all
right. So
it's way too saturated. Other people who have a lot more money than you do are buying in bulk and selling at a price that you can't meet.
All right, I'm deflated now. Oh, my big idea. It's over. Okay.
Now,
so go ahead.
Come up with a new design. Like, I've been seeing these new sippy cups that have, they're kind of like a designed sippy cup where there's a cup and then a top it thing, and you can do like a design on it, and it's not a typical sippy cup. So that's a unique differentiated product, and that might make more sense.
Okay.
So the very first thing that we do is look at the product that you want to copy or that you're inspired by, and look at the competitive landscape. What are you looking at in terms of the investment to get in? Is it something where the average number of reviews to get on the first page is 200 plus reviews? That's going to be a really significant cost to even get on the first page. That's the first step. What is my investment to even get into this market? For something like a tablet, let's talk about tablets. The tablet market is pretty saturated by a lot of the big brands, and there's a lot of small brands too. And so what I would do for that is I would first say, what are the target features that customers want in a tablet, and then summarize those. Then I would say, what are the regulatory safety and quality expectations of a tablet? With a tablet, you not only have the regulatory requirements for making sure that your wireless device is registered with the FCC, the Federal Communications Commission, you also need to meet safety requirements for the charger. You need to meet the energy efficiency standards for California and the Department of Energy. You also need to make sure that you're registered in each state where you have Nexus or that you're selling the product, because all tablet-type items with a lithium-ion battery need to be properly disposed of. And so in most states, that's considered e-waste and you need to be registered. There are issues with lithium-ion batteries, so that would need to be tested. The packaging would need to be tested to be compliant with UN 38.3, the lithium-ion battery packaging requirement. So that's the regulatory compliancy side of it. And then we go into basically what's called customer sentiment, for lack of a better term. We go through what are the 4- and 5-star reviewers saying about the product, and then what are the 1- and 2-star reviewers saying about the product. Where can you go wrong with this product? And where can you go right? What are customers wanting? And I think the 4-star reviews are actually the best because they're customers who liked your product but not enough to give it 5 stars. So they usually have pretty good feedback on how to make it better.
Yeah, there's a thought there. Somebody put some thought into it. So I mean, what you just blew all of our minds with all that detail, it's real, right? And I don't think a lot of people are thinking about this stuff, and hence the reason they're having some trouble, right? You know, they're going into the silicone mold, marshmallow fork thing, and not looking at the rest of the market, right? Your counsel would have been, whoa, this is a saturated market. This is not going to be great.
Exactly.
Maybe this is a better market.
Yeah, or you have to choose a very particular part of the market to be in. So if I were to say go into a garlic press, the only kind of garlic press I would ever recommend anyone do is – launch a brand that's like OXO. Everyone knows that OXO is high quality. It's excellent product. And your garlic press that you pay for is going to be a cast product. It's aluminum alloy. And the connector between the top and the bottom is very thick and tough. And even if I'm paying $25 for this garlic press, I'm not buying another garlic press for a very long time. Whereas if you're trying to break into the cheap garlic press market, I mean, those things break so quickly, like you're not going to be able to break into that because they're cheap. People don't really want to buy it for one thing, and they're just going to buy something that somebody else has already built up their reviews.
Yeah, you can buy them at the dollar store, right? Mm-hmm. So there's lots of those, right? And I think that's a mistake a lot of people make because you think that selling that is going to give you a business. I don't think it does, right? I mean, that's your point, right? The OXO is a business because they developed the product. They really developed the product line, and they built a business. You're selling cheap knockoffs that are going to break and not be quality. There is no model there, right? As you said, you're making money, but is that really what you're trying to do, just make money, or are you trying to create a business?
And that's where we try to take our clients. Is I'm not going to say that that model of selling cheap stuff, as long as it's safe and you're not violating someone's intellectual property, sell cheap stuff all you want. That's, if someone wants to buy it, then have fun with that. But the ultimate goal should really be to diversify your channels. That's just a classic business 101 strategy. Is you don't want to put all your eggs in one basket. You need multiple channels. Where else are you going to sell that cheapo garlic press? eBay? It's just as saturated there. So how do you diversify? You don't diversify by selling the same cheap stuff everyone else is. You diversify by building a brand and having a defined brand. What does that mean? OXO, everyone knows what OXO means. It's that standard black handles. It always looks the same. It's this cast shiny metal with black features. And it always looks the same and it never breaks. And that's what that brand identity is. And so you want to come up with that for your own product and for your own product line and have that concept from the beginning. What am I trying to accomplish here? What customer am I looking to meet?
Well, and what you just described is a great way to find a product, right? If you find a product that looks pretty neat and you're reading the reviews and it's terrible because all these things are wrong with it, you can fix those things and you now have a product because there are people wanting to buy it. But these things are terrible. Well, and you know, you led into brand, and I'm looking at Amazon Brand Management. So tell me what that means.
So when you're on Amazon, there are only a few ways that you can really tell people who you are as a brand. There's a few ways that Amazon lets you do this through their own marketing systems. You can sign up for AMS marketing, which gives you that brand store thing. It's kind of like signing up for Vendor Express, but a little bit different. Then you can also do Vendor Express or Amazon Exclusives, and that'll get you access to A-plus detail page marketing content. An A-plus detail page is fantastic. It increases conversion by 3 to 10% in most studies. Wow. And basically what it does is you are trying to recreate the in-store experience, but better. So pictures with feature benefit next to the picture so people can see it up close. You can see up-close pictures, comparisons between things. I think the best A-plus detail page I've seen recently was actually a KitchenAid juicer, and they were comparing the different quality models that they had for juicers. There was like the value model, there was the standard model, and there was the superior model, and they were comparing the features that they'd built into each and did close-ups of like the filter on the juicer and how you clean it and how much the juicer makes. And it was a really great detail page. So by the time that you end up reading through the content that they've provided, you feel pretty confident that you know what this juicer is going to do for you.
That's better than 10 reviews, right? That's real.
Oh, absolutely.
You get to see it all. And so what did you say, that 3 to 10% better selling?
Correct. So 3 to 10% higher conversion rate for A-plus detail pages. And you can really only get that through three methods. You can be an Amazon vendor, you can do a Vendor Express, or you can be an Amazon Exclusives. And Amazon Exclusives is available only to brand owners who agree to make their product available to Amazon exclusively. And so it's a pretty good program. I do recommend it to brand owners if their goal is to grow their brand. And Amazon does offer some pretty good marketing content to kind of build that brand presence. So that's on Amazon Brand Presence. The other area that you can do it is in having really consistent packaging and having a really distinctive brand insert card. So what we usually do is, again, we go through that whole packaging process and try to have the colors be consistent. So if your brand image is more sustainability focused, then maybe greens and browns are best for you. If you're trying to have kind of a high-end, I'm expensive and ritzy, then maybe a silver embossed with royal purple, for example. And having a consistent vision for what you're trying to accomplish, where every time the customer opens the box, they know what they're getting. It's about consistency. It's about customer trust in your brand. Then when they open your box, they can see this little card that says something about making you part of their family or something that makes the customer part of your brand, where they're part of the brand story. One thing that I really recommend is having social media and having someone actually run your social media. There's a bunch of independent contractors where you can just have them post content and just.
And do you help people find that? You would help somebody get that piece of it together too with this whole Amazon brand management section?
We don't help with that since that's not on Amazon. So we're really focused just on the Amazon channel. I just tell people you really should have something with social media up. What we help with is in designing that insert card that goes into the Amazon box. And in that, it should say something about how you want to hear from them. And here's our hashtag. Or they can tag you at whatever your handle is. And having that kind of dialogue is and you always have to be within the terms of service, of course. And so it needs to be in the tone of customer service and solving their problems. So we want to hear from you about what went well and what we can fix, and we want to solve your problems. And having it labeled that way, because it's a violation of terms of service to divert customers off of the Amazon platform onto your own. So you can have a customer service number and you can solve their problems from a customer service perspective, but you can't tell them next time, go to my own site and I'll give you 10% off. That doesn't work.
Right, to buy it from here. But you really want to fix the problem, and by doing what you're saying, you really are doing what Amazon wants, which is that person to have a great experience, right? Because if there was something wrong, you fixed it and made the experience right, so you're back to that great experience.
Exactly. And then Amazon's brand improves and yours does.
Wow, you guys. You know, so you have a lot of services, and I'm going to have links to the site. It's thinkcascadia.com. And when you go through here, you'll see the whole team, but the core competencies are all these different things. And so people, I'm sure, are saying, am I ready for a service like Cascadia, what they offer? What would you tell people? What would be your elevator pitch to say that here's why you need our service?
One of the things that we run into a lot is people thinking that they're not big enough or they're not ready for something that's bigger. And what I really want to say to that is it's never been easier to start your own company without having significant startup costs. You can launch your own first product with between $6,000 and $10,000, and it will look like a retail product, but on a seller budget. And that's really where we come in, because we all have worked at various large retailers, and obviously all of us also worked at Amazon. But taking our knowledge and working with you will then turn that product into what looks like a much higher end product than you would likely be able to make on your own.
Love it. Okay, best way to get in touch with you. So I'm going to have thinkcascadia.com. There is a contact us button there. Is that the best way?
It's definitely going to reach everyone, but we also have our wonderful operations manager, Christina, who is the only person who wasn't at Amazon, but she keeps all of us in line. And she can be reached at info@cascadia-pts.com. And there's also a phone number there. So in case you really need to talk by phone, I am personally a bit leery of phones, and it's actually a total Amazon thing. People who are sitting next to each other would chat each other instead of get up and talk, and it's a whole company full of introverts. So,
and you're curt. Remember that. You've been taught to be curt. I'll have links to that, and I'll actually list the phone number too, because I think the elevator pitch was good, because I think people would say, oh, I'm too small for that. But, you know, most people want to reach that success level, and you're helping them get all the tools to say, hey, look, if you really want to get there, you've done this, you got the product or whatever, let's get it right, let's make it right from day one, and let's bring it to market the right way. And I just think that's such a great service, and I can see the need for it. And you really don't have to be very large.
No, and it really does mean that you have to do your own homework. I mean, we're not doing it for anyone. We're providing advice, we're providing guidance in as much detail as we possibly can. But at the end of the day, it's the seller's job to get it done, and we want to help them do that the right way.
Okay, so the goal of this podcast is to help people who are stuck. So you got to leave me with a tip, a trick, something that people can do to get their business moving and from that unstuck point.
You know, I think there's two things that I would say. The first is learn how to read all your reports. There's a ton of reports in Seller Central And a lot of them can give you a ton of really useful information. Learning how to read those reports and knowing what your returns rates are. Maybe you've run through your numbers for the last couple of months and you're just not making as much money as you thought you were. It could be because of your return rates, and figure out why customers are returning it. But use those reports. There's some really great ones for Glance Views and Impressions. The advertising reports have some pretty good stuff on what the search terms are that customers are using. There's a lot of stuff that Amazon doesn't give you, but there's a ton of stuff that they do. And so really using all that data and plugging it back into your business is super valuable. I would say the other thing that can really make a difference is learning what software solutions are out there. There's some really good ones, and there's some that are just not a good fit potentially for your business. So do some shopping. Figure out which of the providers makes sense for you. If you have multi-channel fulfillment, then it may make sense for you to have a software solution that will handle all of your inventory across multiple platforms. Keeping on top of the software side of things really frees up your time so that you can do what you actually enjoy and figure out what you actually enjoy. Like for me, it's not marketing. It's really about the logistics of how does your brand convert to a product? How does that look? How does it function? Let's get this thing moving. Other people are like, ugh, too detailed, boring. I want to do some SEO marketing campaigns. Okay, have at it. That's not my thing. You know what you're good at, know what you love, and then have other people do those things that you don't like for you. And then you can focus on what you love, outsource for software, outsource for other things, and then focus on what you're really good at and what you bring to the table. And that's how you can really grow your business.
Sound advice. Rachel, I really appreciate you taking the time. You got a lot on your plate. You got little ones running around. I just really appreciate it, and I can't wait to hear how your next year goes. Wish you nothing but success. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Take care.
Man, I hope you got a lot from this interview. I know I did. You know, I sit back and I think about the legitimacy of a business and the bringing a product all the way from start to market, but not even just to market, to explosive market. It's there. The potential is there. It happens all the time. It sounds to me like this is a real opportunity. If you have something in mind, this might be the group that can help you really, really advance. Again, think about a real business created with real products that you own in your name, the brand you developed. What's the potential? You know, high seven figures? I mean, think about it. I am. I hope you enjoyed ecommercemomentum.com. Take care.
Thanks for listening to the E-Commerce Momentum Podcast. All the links mentioned today can be found at ecommercemomentum.com under this episode number. Please remember to subscribe and like us on iTunes.